Unstoppable Sound Agency.
Welcome to this edition of Move to Amend Reports, where we connect you with activists and organizers working on the front lines of the democracy movement to bring you the lowdown on corporate rule, corporate personhood, and money as speech. This is the space to find info you need to help pass the We the People Amendment and legalize democracy. I'm Egberto Willis, and
I'm Laura Barnum. We've got a great show for you tonight, folks. Scott Parkin of Rainforest Action Network and Rising Tide North America joins us to talk about nonviolent civil disobedience and its role in transformative change. We'll kick things off with a bit of news first. We'll get the ball rolling after a quick public service announcement.
You can support Move to Amend reports and other Move to Amend programs by joining our $28 for the 28th Amendment monthly sustainer campaign. Pledge $28 a month and help make the We the People Amendment our 28th Amendment to the Constitution. Visit movetoamend.org/donate to sign up.
Tonight we welcome to the program Scott Parkin, an organizer and direct action trainer in social justice and environmental movements. Scott has worked with anti-corporate global justice, anti-war, labor, environmental, and climate movements in North America, Europe, and Australia. Originally from the suburbs of Dallas, Texas, Scott holds a bachelor's degree in criminology from Appalachian State University and a master's in U.S. history from Texas A&M Commerce. Currently, he's a senior campaigner in Rainforest Action Network's Climate and Energy Program and is a member of Rising Tide North America's Core Organizing Collective. He's led campaigns against Wall Street banks, mountaintop removal, coal mining, and the Keystone XL pipeline. Welcome to the show, Scott. It's great to have you here tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Excellent. Scott, it's interesting. You said you're from Dallas, Texas, and you went to Texas A&M. I think you kind of got half of it right because we are Longhorns here. I'm kidding. Anyhow, our mission... Our mission at Move to Amend is to fulfill the promise of government of, by, and for the people by creating real participatory democracy. Beginning with the passage of the We the People Amendment, we recognize that in order to end corporate personhood and money as protected speech, we need to help build an educated, committed, and mobilized democracy movement that connects the dots between different communities, demographics, and issues. So, please tell us about the missions of Rainforest Action Network and Rising Tide North America and your role in both organizations.
Yeah, so Rainforest Action Network's mission is to protect the world's rainforest, their inhabitants, and the ecosystems and climate that sustain and support them. And then the mission of Rising Tide North America is to, in kind of a nutshell, to challenge the root causes of climate change and climate injustice. I would say that my role at Rainforest Action Network is I'm the campaigner, and so in the world of the carrot and the stick, I'm the stick. So I organize pressure campaigns against corporate bad actors, whether they're Wall Street banks, which are funding the coal industry, whether they're they're coal companies, which are directly destroying the planet with things like mountaintop removal coal mining, or whether their oil companies want to build pipelines across the U.S. Within Rising Tide North America, I am an organizer, and we're like a – Rising Tide is a network group. It's an all-volunteer climate justice network. And so we've built up a network of chapters, over 60 at this point, I believe. And most of those chapters run their own local campaigns. against fossil fuels, against banks, against, you know, political bad actors, what have you. And so I do a lot to kind of connect and organize that network. I've also, with both organizations, play the role of a direct action organizer. And so I work with folks to build a team to kind of carry out civil disobedience actions around the country. And then I would also say that I've spent a lot of time lately organizing a lot of local actions here in the San Francisco Bay Area around fossil fuel companies and around other corporate bad actors.
Excellent. Do you find that that you're getting a whole lot of traction among the grassroots, mostly activists, or you guys starting to bring new folks into the fold?
I mean, I think it's a little bit of both. I think the issue of climate change is something that's definitely moving people to get involved. Last September, we saw almost 500,000 people march in New York to send a pretty strong message to the UN and the world about climate change and climate justice. The next day, another 3,000 of us sat in on Wall Street at the heart of global capitalism as Naomi Klein's analysis puts out there that capitalism is driving the climate crisis, and therefore we need to kind of strike at the heart of the kind of capitalist system. I find that the folks in which I work with are a mix of veteran activists and organizers, as well as lots of new people, especially the last few years, maybe since the emergence of the Occupy movement. We've seen a lot more people wanting to get involved in this sort of anti-corporate direct action work.
Interesting. I have some other questions, but Laura, I think, has something for you now.
Well, before we moved on, I wanted to ask about the people themselves. Are you finding that it's a diverse group of people across gender, age, and communities of color?
I would say not as much as we'd like, and I would say that we actually strive to organize, diverse groups of people and get them involved. But I would also say a lot of people who show up without prompting are usually going to be middle class white folks who are usually actually a little bit on the older side, and actually a lot of youth too. But it is an environmental climate world. It's still very much a middle class white sort of issue.
Something we all struggle with. But for the purpose of this conversation, let's make sure we all have the same understanding of the movement terms as it relates to direct action. So,
okay.
Scott, please define civil disobedience and the concept of non-cooperation and what the difference is between them and, let's say, your basic protest.
Right. Just to back it up a little bit, I would actually say that there's a term we frequently use, which is nonviolent direct action, which I see as an umbrella term, and a number of things follow under that. So, non-cooperation, civil disobedience, protests, all of that kind of fall under the umbrella of direct action. Philosophically, when I train, what I talk about with direct action is that we have a political system in this country where we give all of our power to elected officials to reform the system or make change for us. What we do with direct action is we don't give that power to the elected officials, but we instead take matters into our own hands. And that's everything from organizing a protest march to doing a sit-in to blocking bulldozers, building the Keystone Pipeline, as well as a sort of more creative side where, in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, where folks at the Common Ground Collective went and opened up health clinics when the Red Cross and the U.S. government kind of failed, or they went and, gutted houses that were infested with mold and after the waters had kind of receded. To me, direct action is very much I actually often say that direct action is the philosophy, and nonviolence is the strategy. And so with direct action, it's us taking, it's us doing it ourselves. It's us taking the sort of power into our own hands and making things go from there.
And so you were getting there, but why is direct action a necessary component for change?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would say that direct action is a necessary component for change because our political system is actually sort of rigged against us at this point, and that you know, where we're seeing like change really happen in other parts of the world, or where we've seen it happen historically, are people who are organizing marches, people who are organizing civil disobedience, people who are building sort of alternative institutions, which like sort of challenge the power holders. I mean, there's a revolving door in this country between corporations and the government. When someone leaves government, they go become a lobbyist, or lots of people who like work at big banks or other big companies go work in the White House or that sort of thing. And so this is us like sort of like organizing and doing what we can to sort of like directly challenge those power holders.
And how do you deal with the fear of violent arrest and the very real possibility of police violence?
Right. I mean, I would say that when we do trainings and when we prepare people to like be part of a blockade or something like that, is that we go through a lot of like, I mean, a lot of it is just basically planning and organizing and preparing for people. And so it's not, you know, I mean, there's definitely a lot of kind of like spiritual stuff that people use to go through that, but also being organized and planned and prepared is kind of what we need. And so like what I talk a lot about de-escalation and how to deal with like irate bystanders or like aggressive cops or violent cops. But I mean, in the end, if the cops want to be violent, then they're going to be violent. We just need to be prepared and trained for that and kind of willing to accept that.
Now, have you found that the cops in the actions that you've performed thus far been pretty violent, or have you guys been able to sort of prearrange the activities that you're about to do?
I would say that it's a situation by situation thing. I can tell you that geographically, cops are going to be less trained, more prone to like acting out violently in certain geographic regions than others. In places like San Francisco and Washington, D.C., I've found that they're pretty well trained and experienced in dealing with people who engage in like nonviolent direct action. But in Texas, which is where I'm from, you know, I've been to lots of like peaceful protests where the cops have attacked. And so I actually feel like a lot of it's geographic, to be really honest. And I think a lot of it also has to do with the how well trained the police forces are, and honestly, like even budgetary considerations within the police force. Like if you're in like a rural part of red state America, then like those cops are not going to have to deal with this sort of thing. And so they're going to react with like clubs and pepper spray.
Now I think you protested in foreign countries as well.
Yeah. I mean, I've organized actions in Australia and Europe. And I actually did a lot of organizing and training in Australia about 10 years ago, actually 10 years ago this month, which resulted in the Australian government canceling my visa and forcibly removing me from their country.
Now, did you find your cops dealing with you any differently than the U.S. cops?
It was about the same. I'd been to jail a few times before I got arrested in Australia. I did find in the street, like when I was like in custody, the cops weren't much different than they are in the U.S. than being arrested in San Francisco or Houston or somewhere like that. I did find the street cops in Sydney to be much more aggressive than a lot of other places I encountered in the U.S. Like when there were like marches and mobs against marches, you know, I found that the Sydney cops actually acted like it was a rugby scrum, to be really honest.
Really?
Yeah.
That, you know, that's kind of odd because when you think of the relationship to Australia and Great Britain and bobbies and, you know, the fact that they don't carry guns, we tend to think of Brits as being less violent than us. And you would, you know, which is a natural thing to think about, you know, in Australia, too. But it seems, and even Canada.
They carry guns. The Australian cops carried guns. So
they are beginning to take after their American cousins a lot more than their British forefathers, I guess, is what we're seeing.
Yeah, I mean, I would say actually in the U.S. and Australia, and I'm sure this is similar in Canada, is that there's a sort of like frontier identity, which is like you deal with things with like the business end of a gun or of your boot, whereas like the Europeans had kind of, it's been a few thousand years since they progressed out of that. Where in the U.S. and Australia, it's like within the last 200 years.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting.
I like the way you came to that, the frontiersmen. We actually came over to this country as frontiersmen. Interesting. Anyhow, there is a long and proud history of civil disobedience woven in the fabric of U.S. history. From our founding as a nation right up to Occupy and Black Lives Matter movements of today. It is interesting, if not ironic, how rich and powerful white men helped foment resistance and non-cooperation, which led to the Revolutionary War and has now come full circle with those tactics being used against their own rule. In our movement democracy, how can we persuade ordinary people to resist corporate oligarchy and partake in nonviolent civil disobedience to disrupt the status quo?
Yeah, I mean, I actually feel like the power holders are actually the best motivators for people engaged in, like, you know, these little de-democratic movements, these like stop climate change movements, these anti-corporate, anti-capitalist movements. Just yesterday here in San Francisco, there's actually a proposal to build a coal terminal in West Oakland. And there's a rich developer who, you know, has a history of like gentrifying Oakland and like being buddy-buddy with like the local and state political apparatus. And a pretty impressive coalition is actually formed up against him and against the coal export terminals in Oakland. And they had a council meeting last night, and one of the activists basically said that that he had done more to like motivate people to get involved in climate justice in Oakland than anyone in a long time. I actually feel like, I also used to say about 10 years ago, in a lot of ways, George Bush was the best left-wing organizer in the world because he had motivated millions into the streets against war and against corporations. But like, that's all, I kind of say all that a little bit in jest, but I would say that as people like sort of go through this sort of like intellectual and spiritual awakening, that they realize that what the government, what the media is telling them is not actually accurate, and they want to get involved. And so we've developed networks and institutions and organizations to sort of like work with those folks and get them involved. I was part of a project with Rainforest Action Network about 2 years ago called the Keystone Pledge of Resistance, where we built up about 100 action teams around the country to take action on Keystone if Obama were to signal or were to approve the Keystone pipeline, which we're still on hold for at this point. But most of the folks that we trained and built these groups with were not these veteran seasoned activists that have been, you know, blocking bulldozers in Texas around Keystone or getting involved in like the Mountaintop Removal Movement. But they were all new folks who had actually been involved in like electoral politics and helped get Obama elected, and they were very dissatisfied, so they wanted to kind of move into this other arena, which is like nonviolent direct action, which is like the world where, you know, me and many others work and like, you know, build up movements.
Excellent. We'll continue this conversation after a quick public service announcement.
Okay.
Move to Amend's We the People Amendment is the only proposed amendment in Congress that addresses both Supreme Court-created doctrine, corporate personhood, and money as speech, the very foundations of corporate rule. Passing the We the People Amendment is the necessary first step in transforming our democracy to one that truly represents the 99%. Go to movetoamend.org/amendment. Read it and take action today.
You are listening to Move to Amend Reports, where we connect the dots between the current issues of our time and the nature of corporate rule. We're talking with Scott Parkin of Rainforest Action Network and Rising Tide North America. Move to Amend is a very large coalition of organizations, along with many thousands of individual members. We invest a lot of time and energy in building relationships with other organizations, particularly those on the front lines of struggle for economic, environmental, and social justice. At Rainforest Action Network, you promote direct action to preserve rainforests, and at Rising Tide North America, you work directly on causes of climate change. In both of these organizations, you're seeking to build stronger relationships with labor, as is Move to Amend with the recent launch of our Labor Caucus. Labor and environmentalists have found themselves on opposite ends of several disputes among these issues. How are you overcoming your differences to work together?
I mean, I think there's a couple different ways. I feel like, first of all, a lot of the same companies which are trying to oppress workers' rights are the same companies which are looting and polluting from communities, right? Like the same banks which are supporting like the breaking of the labor movement are also the same banks funding coal companies in the south side of Chicago, or excuse me, coal plants in like the south side of Chicago. And I actually feel like there's a lot of common ground, and kind of contrary to like the myth, which is like sort of perpetrated by like the business sector and the right wing, there's a long history of labor and environmentalists working together. Like the United Auto Workers, for example, were like one of the main pillars that supported the first Earth Day, and they actually gave the first big donation. And United Auto Worker organizers actually went out around the country and organized different Earth Day events. Even this year, when the oil workers went on strike at, I think it was like 12 or 13 different refineries around the country, it was like a lot of environmental communities from, a lot of environmental activists from the local communities went out and joined them on the picket lines, provided them with coffee and donuts, things like that. I actually feel like there's a long history of that, and that it's a false division that's perpetrated by like business and the media, particularly the right wing media, that these groups are at odds. Not to say that there hasn't been problems, and we've seen a lot of that as well. But like if you just hear the side of the bosses, then you know there is no common ground. Whereas like we've actually seen a lot of common ground.
Well, we too are part of our amendment is a part of the We the People amendment repeals all corporate constitutional rights, and that is all corporations, including nonprofit corporations. I mean, just
right.
No corporations have any rights, and so unions kind of fall under that whole category of being, you know, a corporate body or legal fictions. And so we too are trying to make the connections to why that doesn't, you know, why that doesn't matter for unions, and so. Thank you for that insight. That should help us move forward.
Yeah, there's actually a great group called the Labor Network for Sustainability, and then one of the things they actually have is they have a whole page on the history of like the environment, the environmentalists and labor working together. They also have a page on like where the conflict's been as well. But there's an untold history around green and labor turtles and teamsters cooperation over the years.
And that's called what again?
The group is called the Labor Network for Sustainability. It's something
okay.
like that.
All right, cool. Thanks.
Yeah. Now, you don't, we have, you mentioned, sorry, sometimes there's a schism between labor and environmental issues. You know, a lot of ways, and this is just sort of a commentary, I have a feeling that breaks down to when you talk about it being manufactured. In fact, it is manufactured because a hungry man who needs a job, he doesn't immediately think about the environment in as much as in the long run, or in the very far out future. Sometimes he probably should. He hurts himself in the short run. So corporations have a way that they can create issues in that regard, so that people believe it's either the jobs or the environment. And I think it's our job, your job, all of our jobs, to make it that it's not an either or either issue. What do you think?
Yeah, that's what I was kind of going at with like the false division, is that like it's not like an either or sort of situation. Like, you know, workers live in communities that are polluted by coal plants or like toxic waste dumps just as much as anyone else.
Right.
And so there's a lot of like I said, there's a lot of common ground that can be had. And I feel like the more progressive labor groups are kind of like already on top of that. But there's some, you know, who are like the building trades, which build pipelines and coal plants and things like that. They have definitely like a vested interest in like making sure that they have jobs doing that. So.
Exactly. And that's where it is that somehow we have to get in. But anyhow, while corporate rule affects every single one of us 24/7, nowhere is it more blatantly obvious than in our environment. When people seek examples of corporate rule, all most people have to do is pull the curtain aside and point to the smog-filled air, dry forests, polluted rivers and streams, gentrified inner cities, bioagriculture and factory farms, and the list goes on and on. We kind of showed that quite a bit in our documentary. I don't know if you've ever seen it, called Legalized Democracy, where we kind of put a whole lot of into perspective. Now, do you believe that the state of our environment is a direct result of corporate rule of government? And if the environment is your number one concern, should ending corporate personhood and money as protected speech be your second?
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely say that those two issues are actually really important. I mean, I would say that part of the paradigm of the existing political system, however, is that the system currently was designed and continues to function as an advocate for, you know, the business community and corporations. And so while I would like to see money out of government and politics and, you know, doing away with corporate personhood, I would also say that Alexander Hamilton and the Founding Fathers, kind of the architects of the way our federal government works, designed the federal government. They said this in the Federalist Papers, that you know, this system exists to go out and advocate for the business community. The military exists to protect business interests abroad, that sort of thing.
It is sad because when you take a look, you mentioned Federalist Papers. Federalist 10 is kind of in probative as well. The way it actually talks about factions and how divisions are made. I imagine you're familiar with that.
Yes. I was a history teacher for a long time. So.
Okay. Excellent. 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 Now, what do we do then? I mean, you mentioned that a lot of this is ingrained within our Constitution and not necessarily within the words, but when you look at the Federalist Papers, which I think was sort of used to explain the Constitution to get some other states to buy into it, how do we then change policies, or I shouldn't say policies because we're talking about constitutionality here. What do we do to ensure that we can break off from that root, if you will?
I mean, I think there's a term. I'm not one for buzzwords, but I kind of like this one, which is relocalize. And I think, you know, people talk about relocalizing food systems or energy systems. And I think that's all really important. I also feel like we need to relocalize democratic political systems, and that if we give locales and municipalities like more power and take it more away from the federal government, then we're going to be like every little thing is going to be like kind of taking power away from them. And don't get me wrong, because I'm very much like think that we need to have like a sort of larger system change that begins with the political system. But I also, you know, am not naive enough to think that we're going to actually overthrow the government or anything like that. But I do think if we like build power in our communities more and more, then like it becomes much more difficult for them to be able to get away with so much. And like the Exxons and the Bank of America of the world also begin to like lose power and influence. And we just need to kind of continue to challenge that in whatever way possible. And some people do that through legal processes, and some people do that at city councils or in state legislatures. I personally do that by organizing direct action. So, and campaigns against corporations.
Well, I think, you know, as you know, you kind of look around and assess the general state of affairs and the breakdown of federal government and soon state government. It's already happening in a lot of states. States are, you know, like take Wisconsin, for example, and what's going on in Detroit, Michigan, and other cities in Michigan, the rebuilding of New Orleans and what happened to, you know, the community of color there, and it's still ongoing 10 years after the storm. When you look at all of these giant failures, the Wall Street crash, I mean, all of it, these are huge, giant failures as far as humanity is concerned. And I see you know, you look at Occupy and Black Lives Matter and also what's been going on globally in South America and in the Middle East and even, you know, the protests that are going on in Europe. It seems to me that the tools that are being most effective in our toolbox right now are these nonviolent direct action happenings because, you know, lobbying, I mean, polls make it clear where the American public is on a number of issues, and yet our elected officials do exactly the opposite. So, you know, this idea of being able to achieve good policy outcomes through the channels, you know, through our rules, through the rule of law, isn't necessarily, you know, isn't working. It just plain isn't working. You've got the TTP and the TTIP and T's, they're not working. You know, people are screaming in the streets and, you know, they're being passed. So how do we begin to get people moving out of those silos? You know, how do we get people to stop repeating things and expecting a different outcome? How do we get people to actually think about resisting? Because when you think about it, resistance will brings the whole thing down. If people just choose to resist it and not be participatory in it, the whole network, you know, the whole capitalist, you know, corporate structure will begin to crumble.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think part of it is that you need to meet people where they're at, because we on this call probably have a political analysis that says this is what we need to do and needs to happen, and here's the problems. I don't think a lot of other people have that. Like, the mainstream doesn't have that. I do think they see problems going on and they say, hey, drilling in the Arctic is bad. It makes a lot of sense that all these people in Seattle and Portland are twirling down. And I think that meeting people where they're at, that these like issues, like, you know, the movement for Black Lives is actually a really good example of that. It's like, hey, there's a lot of young Black men being murdered by police. Something needs to happen. And then when you see people taking bold action, which is the Black Lives Matter movement, we begin to see a shift, right, in public opinion around police brutality and around, you know, sort of anti-Blackness in this country. And so I kind of think that part of it is that we need to sort of ride a wave or ride a momentum. And then I think part of it is that we also need to be kind of pushing envelopes and challenging these things. We need to not be satisfied with what the status quo tells us.
So true.
Yeah.
I have known David Cobb, who I think works with y'all, for a long time. We actually knew him back when I lived in Houston. And he used to say, when people ask me what we need to do to like make change or do something, he's like, everything. And so I kind of feel like that's like a really important thing, is that we need to come in from a whole bunch of different sides and kind of just like continue to like kind of like erode and grind on like the power holders, the corporations, the establishments, the politicians, the Hillary Clintons and Obamas and Trumps, and just kind of continue to grind on their on what they stand for and what they are defending.
So true.
Well, we actually have a little program called, a campaign called Pledge to Amend, which is kind of about that, which is, you know, our members are reaching out to to candidates at the local level, state level, and even federal level to educate them about our amendment and get them to signal their support of the amendment with the hope that, you know, these people will get elected, so when the moment comes to vote on our amendment, they'll be in office.
Right.
You know, so we're going at it from that angle as well as the grassroots angle. But we do recognize that any action by Congress is not likely at all, and that there's great response among people because they're just so darn frustrated, and they're finally connecting the dots about what's wrong, what's going wrong in government.
Right.
Okay, so we are almost out of time. So what kind final comments would you like to leave with our listeners? And please let folks know how they can get involved with Rainforest Action Network and Rising Tide North America.
Yeah, I would say the first thing I would say is that Rising Tide has been doing this initiative this year called Flood the System, where we put out a sort of call to action for folks to act in the lead up to the climate talks in Paris. And so if you want to find out more about that, you go to floodthesystem.net, and there's actually places on the website where you can plug in and get involved. That's definitely what Rising Tide's big project has been this year and probably be into 2016 as well. And as far as Rainforest Action Network goes, our website is rand.org, and we have a number of campaigns going on. I would say that the ones I'm working on most closely right now are the bank campaign. We actually launched today a pressure campaign against Morgan Stanley over their financing of the coal sector. And then the other kind of campaign we're working on is around public lands. And so something like 25% of the fossil fuels that are burnt from the U.S. come off of public lands and out of public waters. This is things that led to the BP oil spill, and this is like what the Arctic drilling is sort of about. And so we have pressure campaign is really focused on President Obama in his last year of office. So to get involved with that, I would go to rand.org.
And I also invite you and your associates to check out our petition at Move to Amend and sign the motion to amend.
Excellent. Thanks.
It was a pleasure having you, Scott.
Yeah, it was fun being on.
To learn more about corporate personhood, money as protected political speech, and how to get involved with the campaign to amend the Constitution, visit movetoamend.org. And don't forget to sign the motion to amend at movetoamend.org/motion.
That's it for this edition of Move to Amend Reports. Good night and have a great week.
Move to Amend Reports was created and brought to you by Move to Amend. Produced by national team members Keon Bliss, Laura Bonham, Egberto Willis, and Caitlin Saposi Belknap, with the assistance of Renee Babcock, and with contributions from Move to Amend staff and affiliates. Opening theme entitled Move to Amend, performed by Shimako Noble and produced by Soul Circuitry.